Hi, my name is Jess Graham, and I'm the community builder at the Transnational Institute, and I'm here to ask for your help. The work of TNI is important and cannot be done without financial resources. If you like the work we do, I encourage you to support TNI. You will help us to continue strengthening international social movements with research, reliable information, sound analysis, and constructive proposals that advance progressive, democratic policy change and common solutions to global problems. We need your help to retain a loud and independent voice in this environment. Please go to tni.org and at the top of the page, click Support Us. You can make a one-off donation or sign up as a friend of TNI and pledge a regular contribution that will help us to continue the vital work being done. Thanks a lot.
We are in a climate crisis. About this, there seems to be broad consensus. But there is more and more divergence around what must be done to stop it. As COP26 came around, we've seen more and more supposed solutions to the climate crisis gaining attention. But a closer look reveals that many of the ideas proffered as ways out of the emergency are merely duds, fancy ways to give the impression of progress while business continues as usual. Just as we cannot expect mosquitoes to cure malaria, we cannot expect the people that created the crisis to be the ones to solve it. At TNI, we've been tackling the problem from multiple perspectives, drawing from decades of research and analysis, and leaning on the knowledge and experiences of movements across the world. We believe that the ideas that come from the ground up, from indigenous communities, from peasant farmers, fisher peoples, and workers across the world, have the capacity to bring about a totally different way of being, a different humanity with a different relationship to each other and to the planet. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. In today's episode, I speak with a few of my colleagues and associates to draw out what we think are the approaches that will pull us back from the edge of the cliff. From radical cutting-edge analysis that exposes the problems with the global neoliberal system, to new ideas about how to think about public services, to alternative approaches to food policy, trade and energy. These are ideas that we believe can literally save the planet. To go deeper into many of the issues discussed in the episode today, please be sure to check out the reading list that is included in the podcast description. My first guest is Katie Sandwell, who coordinates TNI's work on agricultural and environmental justice. Katie points out the problem with the yardstick that is used to measure success, net zero, and the lack of ambition that it represents.
Yeah, I think basically the lack of ambition in the COP, so that the scale and the pace of change being promised by governments is just nowhere close to what we actually need to deal with the climate emergency that we're currently facing. But I think a kind of a second problem that I want to draw attention to is some important ways in which the discussion and the promises around the COP are not just too unambitious, but are also much too narrowly construed and in ways that will really make problems for them down the road, or that will make problems for climate action down the road. And I wanted to raise especially the issue of what's called net zero. So you may have heard a lot of governments and, in fact, other actors like corporations making commitments to reach net zero emissions, or to be carbon neutral by some certain point, usually 2050, but there's a bit of a war of promises with different countries promising earlier and earlier dates. But I wanted to, take a minute to draw attention to some kind of concerns about that concept of net zero. So the idea of net zero relies on what we call negative emissions. So this idea that we can pull carbon emitted by fossil fuels and by other uses back out of the atmosphere at a rate that's high enough to compensate for our emissions. So there are a couple different problems with that. One is just a technological problem about the feasibility, just that the scale at which governments are proposing to do that, as far as we know, just isn't at all realistic. There are two kind of big mechanisms for negative emissions. One is going under the very broad term, nature-based solutions. And it kind of means any kind of solution that's designed to absorb carbon back into the biosphere, back into ecosystems, whether that's like aquatic ecosystems or land ecosystems. But the most common one, or the one that you hear the most about, is planting trees and reforesting. The people who have done the calculations on this, including our friends at Friends of the Earth International, have calculated out that to reach the kind of levels that they're talking about absorbing, we would need to replant an area about twice the size of India. So it's a really major commitment of land. And especially if you think of, you know, countries like the Netherlands making these kinds of commitments, you can see that there will be implications about whose land that is as well. So we see that there are real concerns here about the feasibility, but also about the human rights implications in terms of displacing people and in terms of seizing land that's actually, you know, in use by communities, by indigenous communities, by small scale farmers. Yeah, land which is being used for something already. The second big kind of technology, or the second big kind of negative emissions tool, is what's called direct air carbon capture, which is using technological tools to pull carbon dioxide directly out of the atmosphere and either use it in other industrial processes or re-embed it in rocks like limestone. Again, there's a lot of different kind of issues that emerge around that. But the main one is that the scale that we are currently able to do this is just nowhere close to the scale that's being counted on in a lot of the net zero promises that we're seeing being made. So in essence, at the end of the day, what it looks like is that the whole idea of net zero, which is quite shaky and unclear whether it will actually be possible to deliver on negative emissions at any kind of meaningful scale, is being used just to justify continued emissions. So the idea seems
business as usual, essentially.
Yeah, let's continue business as usual. Let's pump carbon into the atmosphere and just hope that in 10 or 20 years, we can figure out a way to take it back out of it. So governments talk a lot about, oh, we need to act now by making this commitment to net zero. But in fact, it's mostly an excuse to postpone taking real action on reducing real emissions.
So what, how do we change it? What's supposed to be done differently if we're actually going to save the planet?
Yeah, big question. we think that really a key to arriving at that solution is kind of to admit the scale of the problem and to recognize that the kind of just transition that we will need to address the climate crisis is actually a much more fundamental reconfiguring of our society. So it means fundamentally rethinking not just our energy systems, but the way the power is distributed in our society. And this is, we use the concept of just transition to talk about this. And it means that when we look at climate action, we need to think, not just about the energy system, but also about our food system, also about the way that land is distributed and who has access to it, and build towards solutions that put the human rights of all people kind of at the center of the solution. What I think it's like important to bring forward about just transition is that it also puts kind of work and working people at the center of the vision of the transition. We need to pay attention to how people are surviving, how people get the things that they need to live. And that, you know, those systems need to fundamentally be transformed. Human well-being and the, you know, well-being of ecosystems is really fundamentally connected. And what we need to rethink is our whole relationship to nature and our relationship to each other. And we can't kind of rethink one of those without the other.
So food is a fundamental aspect of our existence, essentially, and also a major contributor to the climate crisis that we're seeing. What would be your take on that?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that the food system today is responsible for about a third of all the emissions, all of our greenhouse gas emissions globally. But what is often not factored into that discussion is that not all food systems are created equal in that way, and not all different food systems around the world are equally carbon intensive and equally emitting. So when we think about the emissions from the food system, what we really are talking about is the intensive industrial food system. So this is food production that's carried out on a large scale using large and expensive machinery, using chemical inputs of various kinds, and also mostly producing food, which is then processed, taken to distant locations, shipped around the world, et cetera. So all of those processes are extremely carbon intensive. But that is also not the only food system that we have. A great many people in the world are supported either fully or partially by what's sometimes referred to as the peasant food web, or sometimes also talked about in terms of territorial markets. So this is food which is produced much more locally, usually using much lower emissions technologies, and very often using practices like kinds of agroecological agriculture, which agroecology is usually described as a science, a practice, and a movement, but it's a mobilization towards agriculture, which follows a really different model and which strives to be in tune with and learn from natural processes and to produce food using locally available resources rather than relying on all of these carbon intensive inputs. So this is a really kind of fundamentally different vision of agriculture. And it's a kind of agriculture that, instead of exacerbating the climate crisis, can help to nourish local communities while also cooling the planet. So this, we would argue, agroecology and together food sovereignty, which is the wider political framework in which many agroecology movements are embedded, are some of the real solutions which help us to think through what an actual response to the climate crisis would look like.
Katie's work also entails looking at land rights issues all over the world. A closer look at the COP's goal of achieving net zero would reveal the far-reaching consequences for land rights through, for instance, green grabbing.
Yeah, one of the problems I mentioned about net zero is the possibility for kind of green grabbing, so that communities are dispossessed of their land, which is then used for producing green energy and things like that. The IPCCC, in a recent report on land and climate, started to take some kind of steps towards taking up this issue, right, into looking at some of the threats about land grabbing in climate action. And that's hugely important and valuable that they started to take those first steps. But there too, we find that the framing of it is really quite narrow, because they have tended to frame that discussion in terms of protecting people's land rights, and especially protecting existing land rights by kind of formalizing and regularizing land rights. We know from a lot of the communities who we work with, which are often communities of small-scale farmers and in contexts where traditional and customary land rights are really important, we know that that vision of formalization and of sort of trying to regularize everybody's land rights and make land rights around the world work basically in the way they do in the Netherlands or in Germany is not actually the best solution. And it can actually deepen those dynamics of dispossession in a lot of places. It can lead to people losing access to land, or it can just support and consolidate a regime where already only a tiny percentage of people have access to land, right? So if you formalize and regularize a situation that's already really unjust, mm-hmm. you're not actually going to solve the problem. So we do think there's a huge need in the kind of global thinking and activist thinking around climate to recognize that part of the discussion is going to be also about how we address those kind of deep existing inequalities and injustice in terms of people's access to land and resources. So that it's not enough to just say no new dispossession from green grabbing, although that's very important, but to also say if we have a vision of a just transition, that should also be a vision of a transition to a society where people have access to the resources they need to live a dignified life.
To be corrective also of existing injustice.
Yeah.
Many thanks to Katie Sandwell, TNI's coordinator for our Agricultural and Environmental Justice Program. Lavinia Steinfort is a political geographer and activist, and as a researcher at TNI, she works on public alternatives such as collective ownership of public services, a just transition towards energy democracy, and transforming finance for the 99%. For Lavinia, public services are pivotal to achieving a broad level of comfort and dignity while living within planetary boundaries. Lavinia shares Katie's sentiments about the COP26 not being ambitious enough, and she shares her reservations also about net zero as a goal.
Almost everybody now knows the IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change, has been very clear that the climate crisis requires unprecedented change in all aspects of society, right?
So the COP is not ambitious enough, you think?
Absolutely. It is just supposedly trying to tackle the crisis in the complete wrong way, because those that have caused the climate crisis are really not the actors that will solve it in a way that really guarantees a future for all life on Earth. It really relies a lot on GDP growth and presents the transition as a business opportunity, even though this will really mean that a future will just be impossible for those that are now living on this earth. And instead of a focus on GDP growth, we should actually focus on provisioning for collective well-being everywhere.
So that's the preferred framing then. What would you then have the COP really focus on if you were to set the agenda?
Yeah, if only we have that power, right? But of course, we're building for it. But yeah, I would say on the one hand, it's about degrowing all that is extractive. So destructive mining, speculative finance, mass tourism, but also fossil fuel agriculture, non-essential consumerism, and especially also the false techno fixes that the COP is focusing on. And actually, instead, we need to grow a caring society that puts life at the center. And for this, we actually really need to reclaim and revalue and resource public services, right? But the COP completely ignores the role that public services would play in a regenerative society, even though they require relatively little energy and are really the lifeline of every community. So that's why actually TNI has been calling for deprivatizing and democratizing public services to deliver quality services for everyone.
What are some of the ideas that you'd share from your work?
Yeah, so in our book and research, The Future is Public, you can read all about how to deprivatize and democratize public services. So re-municipalizing them, building new public services together with users, with workers, and to make sure that this is actually part of the climate solution. But also the publicfutures.org database that TNI is hosting with the University of Glasgow is keeping track of these cases on a continuous basis. So people can even file any practices in this field there themselves. So this is really a global effort to make sense of how a democratic economy can look like by focusing on public services. And one of our most recent publications is about democratic and collective ownership of public goods and services, which is much more looking into public community collaborations. So really how to practice new forms of democratic ownership and governance. So to have public ownership is key, but we have to go way beyond, right? And make sure that actually democracy is deepened on all levels, locally, all the way up to national and international.
Can you give a specific example of exactly what that looks like, actually, when we talk about public services?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a growing number of cases. And also historically, we can definitely share many practices that have been around. The city of Plymouth is very exemplary, because there the city council was supportive to create Plymouth Energy Community. And this is a nonprofit cooperative that really works closely with the city to fight energy poverty and develop community-led energy services. So it's really about that interaction and that joint decision-making by a community with their city council. And there are actually also plenty of examples from the Global South. There's a cooperative in Caloocan in Philippines that was created by local women to supply residents of this poor urban community with bulk water. And the profits of this provision are actually paid back to members of the cooperative, but also reinvested in other public services like childcare. So I think that's also really showing how we need to think bigger than every sector, but how to make sure, yeah, these essentials are provided in an integrated fashion. Because a just transition really requires a distribution of wealth and power globally, this does not only require a stop to austerity, to privatization, intellectual property rights, and so on. Of course, not to forget debt cancellation and international reparations and climate finance for global South countries. We also really have to scale up the fight for global public goods and services, because we need to demand that essentials like healthcare and vaccines in light of the pandemic and future health crisis are fundamental human rights. And the same goes, of course, for public finance, for renewable energy and affordable housing. And I think it's really key to hold governments, especially colonial and neocolonial powers, to account that they have international responsibility, right? That countries and communities around the world have the funds and capacity, but also the sovereignty to develop and deliver these necessities in their own fashion that they come to by democratic decision making. So, yeah, I think to replace this logic of profiteering, of competition and accumulation needs to be replaced by values of sufficiency and solidarity and self-determination, and that the fight for democratic, collective and global public goods and services can really help us move in that direction. So hopefully we'll see much more movement building and power building on that front.
Many thanks to my colleague Lavinia, who was breaking down her vision of how global public services can play a major role in reducing emissions and in creating a better world for all. And indeed, there's no escaping that we are all on one globe and that we have to share what it has to offer. Trade is one way in which we've shared the planet's bounty across nations and continents, and attendant to that is global investment. Lucia Bacena does research and activism around issues of trade and investment at TNI. She believes that our global trade and investment regime needs a major overhaul. And one of the main elements to begin with is that of trade agreements. Of all the trade agreements out there, she singles out one in particular on which TNI has recently done lots of research. That is the Energy Charter Treaty, or ECT.
The Energy Charter Treaty is, of course, one of, you know, more than 2,500 investment agreements that are currently in place. But the Energy Charter Treaty, you know, it is the only multilateral agreement that actually talks about energy, or that is very specific on energy. So it was designed, actually, I think this is also important to know, because it's always very relevant to, you know, to pay attention to where things have been designed, you know, like who has been behind all these treaties. And yeah, so the Energy Charter Treaty is, you know, it's a treaty that is designed for and to protect fossil fuel companies, basically. And it's also one of the investment agreements that has been used the most by fossil fuel companies to put claims against countries who are trying to pass, for example, some kind of climate law or energy transition law. Mm-hmm. So there is a big problem with this concrete agreement, but unfortunately, it is not a topic during the COP26.
It's not a topic, but I'm led to believe that the ECT secretariat will be at the COP26 in an official capacity, or is that
yes.
Mistaken?
Yeah, the secretariat, as you will say, is going to be in the COP26. As they have been doing until now, you know, they have a very clear agenda, which is to keep and maintain the Energy Charter Treaty as it is, plus seduce, you know, or convince countries who are in the accession process. So these are countries that are about to sign the treaty or have already, you know, taken some steps to join the Energy Charter Treaty. And they're going to, you know, put on their agenda on why the Energy Charter Treaty is so good for the countries. But unfortunately, there's not going to be any other voices to at least be critical about this focus and to show and to prove that at least until today. So this is like, you know, the treaty was signed in the 90s, so 30 years later, we haven't seen really any advances on what the objectives were of the treaty in terms of international cooperation. But what we have seen is around 300 lawsuits of energy companies, of fossil fuel companies against countries, asking for millions and millions of euros in compensation because of, as investors say, loss of profits. So what is loss of profits for investors are actually rights for the people, or, you know, like, yeah, or for the planet, basically. So there is a huge conflict. Yeah, why should states compensate these big fossil fuel companies at all? But also, why should they compensate when they were investing in countries already knowing that countries are starting to phase out of fossil fuel? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big issue that has to do with conflicts arising from contracts, treaties, and we're probably going to be seeing a lot of this in the future. So this should really be something that is debated in international forums and to be solved, because this is going to mean millions of euros that states could be using for energy transition plans and not to pay off these companies. And also these companies, they already have mechanisms to get compensation at national level. So there is no need to create special corporate courts for them to benefit or to be privileged among all other people or even investors. We will see where the conversations go.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts about the outcomes of COP26? Do you foresee any big changes coming up? People have praised the Paris COP for having at least come up with a goal for countries that are signatories. But what are your thoughts and wishes for COP26? Do you feel positive about it?
Well, I can only speak about the issues that I've been working in, and that has to do with, for example, corporate accountability. I would really like to see some agreement on how to, for example, take corporations to some kind of environmental court and make them accountable for their damages that they are creating to the planet or that they have created in the past. It would be really great to see that states are powerful enough to point at some corporations and to regulate some of their activities. And that on one side, but if we go more to like a international approach, then of course it would be great to discuss around the current trade and investment regime and see what doesn't work, because there are many things that don't work. And yeah, and you know, try to fix the problems. And if there's no way to fix it as it is, then, you know, just start to organize trade in a different way.
Many thanks to my colleague, Lucia Bassena, speaking about the perils of the Energy Charter Treaty. Indeed, hardly anything has a greater impact on the future of our planet than the ways in which we generate and consume energy. While many people are celebrating increases in renewable energy, and during COP26, we know renewable energy is being touted as one of the easy solutions. Research put out by TNI and the Trade Unions for Energy Democracy rings the alarm. In a paper called The Energy Transition Myth, the authors look at the numbers and use them to challenge many of the claims that renewable energy will soon replace all fossil fuel, and shows rather that fossil fuel use has increased together with renewables. Essentially, they show that it is not true that the transition to a sustainable, low-carbon future energy system is already underway. Here's Sean Sweeney, the coordinator of the Trade Unions for Energy Democracy.
I think then that the main message of this conversation is the need to us to politically come to terms with the fact that there is not an energy transition, but there's an energy expansion, and that the current policies, which are based on a sticks and carrots approach, incentives and carbon pricing, that approach has been ineffective now for 30 years. And we need a massive policy shift at the global level towards a global public goods approach. Will that new approach solve the problem? We don't know. We do know that energy use has been growing now for generations. And so it's not going to be easy with any set of policies to have a dramatic effect quickly, but we can lay the foundations for a new approach. But that means a whole debate about what constitutes sustainable living, consumption, everything would be open for debate. And we can have that debate based on the facts, based on the realities, and not on based on some idea, some fanciful notion that the private sector and private profit is going to lead us to a low carbon future. So if we can start with that, we've made a lot of progress, in my opinion.
Many thanks to Sean Sweeney, the coordinator of the Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, a network of more than 80 unions from around 25 different countries. So it's clear that if we are to save the planet, we have to fundamentally change human society. We have to think differently about everything, from the way we arrange our public services, the way food gets to our tables, how we trade with each other and the agreements that sustain that trade. We have to find a different way to satisfy our need for energy. There are many positive and exciting initiatives and ideas that are moving us closer, one step at a time, to a sustainable world. Communities are finding each other, and the voice for change is only getting louder. It'll take courage and a lot of work still to get anywhere close to achieving the vision of a more just and equitable world. But even as we strive to create a better future, we have to continue to fight injustice in the present. Climate change is already claiming victims, today as we speak. Unfortunately, the response from powerful nations has been to label those who move to other places in search of a better life as threats. Nick Buxton is the coordinator of our Future Labs at TNI. He works actively on issues of border politics, climate change, militarism, and economic justice. In this clip, he explains the key content of our recently published primer on climate security, which warns about the dangers of militarizing the climate crisis.
In 2021, it seems every political leader is talking about climate change as a security issue. Not only did UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson chair UN Security Council session on the issue, President Biden has also declared climate change a national security priority. But what are its implications? Whose security are we talking about? At the Transnational Institute, we have been tracking this issue for more than a decade. We noticed that just as the world's leaders were failing to drastically reduce emissions, they were developing plans to deal with the consequences of the climate crisis. Nearly all the wealthiest countries have now produced climate security plans, and they are very clear about whose security they are prioritizing. And it's not the security of the majority of the world most affected by climate change. Instead, they are worried about military bases worldwide being flooded. They are anxious about the impact on global supply chains and its impact on corporate profits. They warn about the increase in migrants and conflict due to climate change. And as they do so, these climate security strategies start to paint the victims of climate change as threats. That's the problem with security. It seeks to secure what already exists, which is an unjust status quo. And it turns anyone who threatens to destabilize that status quo as threats to security. That is why we must reject a language of climate security. Solutions to the climate crisis will not come from approaches rooted in nationalism and militarism. It will not come from those who caused the crisis. After all, the military is one of the world's biggest carbon polluters. What we need is climate justice, solutions focused on tackling the causes of climate change, rather than its consequences. We need climate justice, not climate security.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. I'd like to thank all of our guests who came to share a few ideas that we think can save the planet. Katie Sandwell, Lavinia Steinfort, Lucia Bassena, Nick Buxton, and Sean Sweeney. Please check out the podcast description for our extensive COP26 reading list and links to other relevant material mentioned in this episode. All of this material is free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, and see you next time.